ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's always been the lucky country. Sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Did you make a reading resolution for the new year, I wonder? Time to tackle Middlemarch or get your head around Romantasy. Maybe this is the year to read James Joyce or all of Helen Garner, to only read books in translation, to read more books from Indonesia or the Pacific, or to champion Australian fiction. Or how about this one? Read poetry every day, or at least every week. Hello there and welcome to this summer edition of The Bookshelf here on ABC Radio National. I'm Kate Evans, delighted to be revisiting an onstage discussion about poetry in the middle of the year. Let's talk poetry, with a focus on the very best of the 21st century. Hello and welcome to this poetic edition of The Bookshelf here on ABC Radio National in partnership with Red Room Poetry and the State Library of New South Wales, which of course is on Gadigal land, part of the Eora Nation. I'm Kate Evans and I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land, the first storytellers, and to pay my respects to elders past and present and to First Nations people both here with us and listening all around the country. And we're here to talk poetry in the context of the ABC's Top 100 Books Countdown, the best poets, collections, individual poems of the past 25 years. We'll also talk about what poetry is, what it does, perhaps even how it works. And to do that, we're joined by poets and readers. Maxine Beneba-Clark, who writes for both adults and children. Her books include How Decent Folk Behave and, coming out soon, Beautiful Changelings. Sarah Holland Batt, poet and academic, whose collections include Fishing for Lightning and The Jaguar. Daniel Browning, broadcaster, historian and academic, whose latest book is Close to the Subject. And political journalist, historian and writer Julia Baird, whose books include Phosphorescence, Bright Shining and an intimate biography of Queen Victoria. Why don't you welcome them all? Daniel Browning, can I begin with you? I mean, as an arts journalist and Indigenous broadcaster at the ABC, we'd worked together for years. So I knew you as a fine interviewer and writer, someone who works in cultural history, a literary judge, but I hadn't known you were also a poet. So what does poetry mean to you?
Look, I should say that I don't regard myself as a poet. Poetry is, I say poetry is, for all the answers, for all the questions that don't have answers, there's poetry. So everything that I can't answer that kind of escapes my rational mind, I answer with poetry.
I love the way that we're going to build up through all these different answers, different takes on what poetry might be. So all the unanswered things from Daniel. Now, Maxine Beneba-Clark, you work both on the page and out loud, and you write for both kids and adults. So how did you come to poetry, or how did it come to you?
I came to poetry first through my father's record collection. He would listen to groups like The Last Poets. There's a song by James Brown called Heroin King.
Yes.
It's like a spoken word poem. And that was when I first kind of started falling in love with poetry. It was on the airways before it was on the page.
All the different ways that poetry comes to us. So, Sarah Holland Batt, you're a poet yourself and an analyser of poetry as an academic. Is it possible to somehow encapsulate both of those things as I ask you what poetry means to you?
Well, yes, because I think for me, I get more joy out of reading poetry than writing it, and I'm probably not alone in that. I think writing a poem is the act of really grappling with language and sort of searching, like Daniel said. Whereas for me, reading poetry and writing about other people's work, there's nothing but pleasure because you have the joy, I think, of trying to meet another human being's, you know, deepest attempt to express the inexpressible. So for me, I get enormous joy out of writing about poetry and reading other poets' works closely, and that's what made me become a writer, was the works of others, as is so often the case.
Now, Julia Baird, after years as a historian and as a political journalist, you turned your thoughts and your writing towards beauty, awe and wonder. Has poetry always been a part of that for you?
Definitely. Always since I was a kid. I've always really loved poetry. Ever since, like, Anne of Green Gables used to speak about the horns of Elfland faintly blowing, right? And that got me in love with Tennyson. And a lot of those kind of, like, poets of that period who were talking about a yearning and a desire to move beyond, like he would talk about, and this grey spirit, yearning and desire to follow the utmost bounds of human thought. There was something about a reaching and a stretching beyond. So to me it was like, explaining something, not that touching on something ineffable and something magical, but I think as time went on and I saw a lot of women writing poems, that meant a lot to me because they were carving up and explaining and dissecting what it meant to be a woman and the very particular griefs or pains and anxieties and beauties around that as well. So there was a kind of a real realism. And I think now for me, I love it in so many of its different forms and I read it every day, but like, I think that the poetry that I love the most points again to something that will sustain us, whether it's the natural world or whether it's a moment of holding someone's hand or whether it's a nurse sponging the body of a patient. There's some beauty in all of those interactions that remind us what it is to be alive, all those different things.
But all those different things, you have all described something that is about reaching from one place or one person or one idea to another as a point of connection. But here on ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf and at the State Library and in an imagined Red Room poetry space, we're talking about poetry and what might be on your list of the very best poems of the last 25 years. So before we get to that, I guess we need to grapple with why the past 25 years, and that's the focus of our ABC Top 100 Books Countdown. So if we think of what's happening this century, Maxine Beniba-Clark, what changes have you seen over the last 25 years?
I mean, I think poetry has become a lot more accessible with the rise of the internet. I think that, you know, things like the COVID-19 lockdown, people being indoors, and that idea that many of the other panellists have talked about of poetry being a way that you grapple with the world. And the world is a mess at the moment. In some ways it's always a mess, but it particularly feels like the last 20 years has been an interesting and kind of poignant time to create poetry.
What about the performative side of it? I mean, because I think you started in slam poetry yourself.
Yeah, so I started out in slam poetry in the 2000s, mid-2000s, and it had just arrived here. It took off in the United States in the 1980s, slam poetry I'm talking about specifically, and that was a space where I saw lots of young poets who were from marginalised communities who maybe didn't have access to traditional publishing routes and who were also from oral traditions actually being able to participate in writing, performing, generating poetry. So for me, I was at the microphone way before I was at the page.
Sarah Hollenbatt, what else is exciting or significant in this period for you?
Well, I think poetry in many ways tracks what happens in the world. So, you know, you find poets responding to the things that we're all seeing, thinking about, worrying about, from geopolitics to the environment, our natural world. In Australia, there's been a really, I think, important grappling with our history, with our colonial history, some amazing Indigenous voices coming through Australian poetry. So I think in the last 25 years, there's been a great, I suppose, opening up of territory poetically that reflects the changes in the way people are thinking and writing. I mean, you think about the great moments of social progress, you think about gay marriage, all of those things I think are reflected with and contended with in different ways in poetry. Poetry is not always a documentary form, but it does tend to respond and often be ahead of what's happening in the world. So I'm thinking there of, say, the confessionalist poets in the 1950s and 60s in America writing about taboos, basically, at the time, writing about mental health, writing about their personal experiences of motherhood, depression, you know, all of that stuff that at the time was not considered the proper subject for poetry, and now, of course, is really sort of present in our discourse, in the way we talk. And, you know, those taboos have been shattered through poetry. So I think poetry often is ahead of the curve, but also responding to the great kind of social and political kind of issues of the time.
Well, building on that, Daniel Browning, what would you say about Indigenous poetry in Australia over the, or in Australia or elsewhere, actually, over the past 25 years?
Well, I mean, I think there's been a great flowering, but I would tend to think that's something to do with the publishing industry kind of making space. I think there was always a strong body of, you know, vocalization of using language in a kind of almost musical way to talk about stories, to talk about, you know, oral history, to pass things down. But yeah, I think it's more to do with a turn in the publishing industry and a turn more broadly culturally. So now our voices are being heard because, you know, it's time and we've been demanding to be heard for a long time. So, I mean, I think there's an extraordinary flowering in First Nations poetry, and, I mean, Evelyn Araluen winning the Stella for a book of poetry, and poetry wasn't actually allowed to be, people weren't allowed to judge poetry in the Stella prior to that. So her getting that, and Ev was one of those people who I had come on the show in 2016 when I was presenting Away on Radio National, and I was able to watch her grow. I mean, she's streets ahead of me now, but you know, she was a young university student, and you know, just seeing that flowering is also for me incredibly pleasing. And she's just one poet I've seen that with. So being in a great position to observe the culture shift, it's been magical.
And I promise we will be bringing you all examples of these poems as well. But just sticking with the idea of this 25-year period, Julia, you said that you read poetry every day. What then has changed for you over the past 25 years? Are there particular patterns that you've seen or something in your own engagement?
I just read a lot more because I'm thirsty, really, and I'm kind of looking for something and I'm interested. But it kind of, hearing you guys speak reminds me of, you know, how there's this revived debate about at the moment about the Mercator map of the world created in the 1500s. And it was created by men who were navigating the world then, right? And it was accurate to the shape but not to the size of all the continents. So England, of course, in the middle, that's never varied. England right in the middle. Africa, much smaller than it should be. Greenland, for some reason, huge. It's not that big, you know, but did Donald Trump know this? Would he want to buy it if he realised it's a lot smaller than he thinks? So in a way, I think poetry has been a corrective to those kinds of maps and those assumptions, that the most important kind of poetry is kind of like men in positions of power usually speaking very slowly and ponderously about from wildflowers to matters of state. And I think that there's been groups who have been positioned on the margins and told that they're on the margins, but actually that's because of the way the map has been drawn. There's rival maps, by the way. Every map gets something wrong because it's a globe. So spreading a globe flat, you're going to get something. But if you get size right, the shape goes a bit wonky. But anyway, it's very interesting. But to me, that seems part of what poetry has been about. And I was thinking this because we've had to write poems as an ambassador for the Red Room. And oh boy, for this, I had to come up with a poem. I was like, oh no. Like, I have so much reverence for all of you and the work that you do, and I love it so much. And I wrote such terrible poetry when I was a kid and teenager. I used the word shroud over and over again. Everything was shrouded. I don't know what it was, but anyway, it was just so, it was dreadful.
Julia, I will confess, I once wrote a poem about a zephyr.
Oh, Zephyr.
Yeah.
Although,
it's a bit like a shroud.
Candy Royale has that great poem, they will know that I was a hurricane and not a zephyr. Mm. And I love that line from her, which is exactly right. It was exactly what she was.
Beautiful voice.
And also, I'm so glad that you've given us something specific, Candy Royale there. And what we're already hearing, I guess, is the way that this is an expansive form and it can do entire maps or it can do the tiniest, tiniest moments. So let's get some examples, a quick fire round, as they say in all those British panel shows, of a poem or a poet or of a particular collection. We'd love a reading too, so prepare yourselves. Where would you like to start, Sarah?
I'll start. I was thinking about this question of best and what best means. And for me, they're the poems that you want to live with. You know, for me, a best poem is a poem that rewards repeated rereadings and where you find something extra every time you kind of return to it. So those are the poems that I've tried to choose. I'll start with a poem that has proven a really lasting poem of the 21st century. It's by the Polish poet Adam Zagajewski, and it was published in The New Yorker not long after 9/11, and it was one of the rare poems, poetry and viral are not two words that often appear in the same sentence, but this poem really went viral and has remained, I think, a lasting touchstone, not necessarily just of that particular geopolitical moment, but as a kind of touchstone that people do return to, and it's one that I love, and so I'll start with that. It's called Try to Praise the Mutilated World. Try to praise the mutilated world. Remember June's long days and wild strawberries, drops of rosé wine, the nettles that methodically overgrow the abandoned homesteads of exiles. You must praise the mutilated world. You watched the stylish yachts and ships. One of them had a long trip ahead of it, while salty oblivion awaited others. You've seen the refugees going nowhere. You've heard the executioners sing joyfully. You should praise the mutilated world. Remember the moments when we were together in a white room and the curtain fluttered. Return in thought to the concert where music flared. You gathered acorns in the park in autumn, and leaves eddied over the earth's scars. Praise the mutilated world, and the grey feather a thrush lost, and the gentle light that strays and vanishes and returns.
I love that. Mm-hmm. That's so beautiful.
And that one, Adam Zagajewski's Try to Praise the Mutilated World. Maxine, what would you like to give us?
I'll give you a poem by Warsan Shire, who's a black British poet, born in Kenya to Somali parents, a refugee background. And she was, I think, a young poet laureate of the UK for a while. I'm not sure if she still is. And someone who kind of beavered away for a while and then absolutely exploded because Beyoncé sampled some of her lyrics. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to read the whole poem because it's quite long, just an extract, but it's called Home. And I tend to gravitate toward poems that capture a moment in history. I really kind of resonate with what Julia was saying, Daniel and Sarah as well, about that idea of poetry grappling with things that are very difficult. And this grapples with the movement of people around the world, which I think is one of the great conundrums of our time due to war and climate change and lots of other things. Home by Warsan Shire. No one leaves home unless home is the mouth of a shark. You only run for the border when you see the whole city running as well. Your neighbours running faster than you, breath bloody in their throats. The boy you went to school with, who kissed you dizzy behind the old tin factory, is holding a gun bigger than his body. You only leave home when home won't let you stay. No one leaves home unless home chases you, fire under feet, hot blood in your belly. It's not something you ever thought of doing until the blade burnt threats into your neck, and even then you carried the anthem under your breath, only tearing up your passport in the airport toilets, sobbing as each mouthful of paper made it clear you would not be going back.
Mm. Wow. Thank you. And that's from Home by Warsan Shire. So far we've had Broken World, Great Movements of People, so big themes, big ideas. Daniel, what do you want us to think about?
This came to me when I was getting out of the Uber. I thought, what's that poem? It's in my head. And David from Red Room actually helped me find it. All I had was the title, and I couldn't remember whether it was 6 feet or 7 feet or 8 feet or 9 feet of land rights. But this is a piece called 6 Feet of Land Rights by Graham Dixon. But I'm only going to read you the very smallest excerpt. If we never succeed in reclaiming our country, doomed to live life paying rent to the gentry, it would be a good thing if after our death day, for that 6 feet of earth, we didn't have to pay. Then when the reaper comes to switch off our lights, our souls may rest in peace, knowing at last 6 feet of land rights.
Oh. And that Graham Dixon?
Graham Dixon, Noongar poet, passed away 15 years ago. Holocaust Island was his collection. There's just so much in that. It's just a snippet.
Well, that was just beautiful. Julia Baird, do you have one you'd like to share with us?
I'll just do one. I wrote a book about the media treatment of female politicians in Australia and the history of it. It was called Media Tarts. When this first came out, I used a poem by Les Murray at the opening of it, in which he spoke about, in any given moment in Australia, a woman is being crucified by the press. Mm-hmm. He talks about these feasting grins of like, and then they, but you know, for him then, he mentioned Helen Demidenko, mentioned Pauline Hanson, for me then writing the book, it was about Cheryl Kernow, it was about this endless string of women. They finished with one, they moved to the next. When I reissued that book a couple of years ago, there was much more of a point to it. Women were in the streets protesting what happened to them in Canberra as staffers as well as politicians. And I came across this poem that completely blew me away. It was so succinct and so perfect. It was by a poet you might know, Maxine Beneva Clark. And I asked her for permission to put it in this new version of my book, and it's called Capital. Sorry if I read this really badly. She writes, in grade five, they bus our children to the Capitol, to the long white building, high, majestic, on the hill, where the boys mostly learn, you study hard and you might well work here one day, mate. And the girls hang back and button their collars, because this place is where women get raped. How powerfully put is that?
What does it mean to hear somebody else referring to your poetry, Maxine?
I'm speechless. And beautiful reading as well. I mean, that's what I write poems like that for, so that hopefully they'll travel and they'll resonate and they'll be of use to other people. Yeah.
But I guess the other thing, just sitting here listening to that poem, is it hits you with a punch, and it's got an emotional heft as well as a political heft. And so when we talk about what poetry does, how important is the emotion of it, Sarah?
Well, I think there's all sorts of poems that do all sorts of things. So some poems operate on a really intimate scale where you're reading a love poem written for someone, you're reading someone's grief, you're reading an elegy. Other poems speak outward in what I would consider more of a public voice. And I think either way, a poem can resonate in you in a range of ways. So it's not always that a poem brings you to tears. Sometimes it makes you think. I think that there's such an array of different possible responses to poetry. And sometimes it is a gut punch where you immediately feel a sense of illumination. Other times, and I love the kinds of poems where you read them and there's a mystery and you want to return to them and ponder over those lines. You know, one of my great my favourite poets is Wallace Stevens. And if you tried to explain line for line what a Wallace Stevens poem means, good luck. But if you can just relax and enjoy the beauty of the music of the way Wallace Stevens writes, there's a richness there that you can return to that's not necessarily always emotion. So, yes, I think great poems do move us, but they also prompt us to think, to live with language. I think if I can put it that way, that's really what a good poem does for me. It's the ideas, it's the emotion, but then it's how those ideas and emotion are couched in the particularity of language that's what makes a poem last.
I really think poetry, for me, poetry is defined by words that do something. It has to do something. You're talking about what poetry does. Well, it has to do something. It has to have force in the world. And I know that's kind of, it's not classically what poetry is meant to do. You know, I write it because I want it to do something. I want it to change a mind or a heart or to comfort, to galvanise someone, to do something. There's always, for me, a suggestion of activity. And this is a kid who grew up, you know, the first kind of serious poet I was introduced to was Gerard Manley Hopkins.
Ah, same.
You know, all about the assonance and this and that and piebald horses and
yeah.
Colours, you know, like, you know, I learnt a lot, but perhaps what I didn't learn is, you know, why you write poems. For me, it has to be about, I won't write poetry about piebald horses. I won't write poetry about colours. It would be an abrogation of me as a black fella to just write poetry about nothing.
It's about placing it in Australian context as well. We don't talk to each other about the piebald horses we saw on the weekend, you know what I mean? Like, I remember reading Oscar Wilde talking about, you know, he says about Dawn was a silver-stockinged...
Yeah.
Or was it a woman?
It's creature, not silver.
Creeping along the street in silver-stockinged feet. And I'm like, man, in Australia, Dawn is an arsonist that gets a petrol can, spreads it on the horizon and throws a match.
Yes,
you know, like,
absolutely.
It's just such a different environment we're writing in.
But, I mean, that was how I learned how to work with words. It's like, okay, well, he's talking about his own context, Gerard Manley Hopkins, you know, Catholic seminarian, poet in the mid-19th century in the UK. But I could transfer the ideas well enough. But I just don't spend any time on those things anymore. And if I do, it's probably three or four lines. It's a really, really short poem.
But I can imagine Hopkins caught this morning's minion could be soaring over an Australian landscape as well.
Absolutely.
And so there's a couple of things there. I mean, there's the language and the beauty of language. Mm-hmm. But the reason that I raise the question of the emotion is because it seems to me that there is sometimes a resistance to the sentiment of poetry, as if it's something that we should be afraid of or label as mawkish or perhaps be suspicious of. And so I wonder, Maxine, what are those, all the roiling emotions that don't have to be but can be explored in poetry? And your poem that Julia read, that hit me. What does that do to your understanding of what poetry can do, what act it does in the world?
Yeah, I think for me, the poets that I love, they have, well, as an adult, they have that, you know, punch to the heart. You know, I read something and I just think, oh my goodness, you know, I've been wanting to say that, or I've been thinking that, or this has just given me a completely new perspective on the world. That said, I also write poetry collections for children. So I have written about peanut butter. I've written poems
TikTok.
About,
and
you know,
TikTok
and tomato sauce. There is something in just writing for the joy of something as well. And in fact, in coming here, I was looking at the poems I've chosen. I thought, all of these are really quite poignant and dark, and but they're also all love poems. You know, the one I read by Warsan Shire, that's a love letter to a home that you had to leave. So that idea that because it's kind of focusing on one emotion, and I would argue as well that the poem that Daniel read, that poem is also a love poem to land and to country, and as much as it's like a funeral eulogy as well. So that idea that it might be steeped in emotion, but depending on who we are when we're reading it and depending on the way we look at it, there can be, you know, the flip side of the emotion in it as well.
And Charlie Chaplin said, poetry is a love letter to the world. I mean, I read that written in chalk on a Swiss chalet a couple of years ago, and it was written on a place. It was a poet's house. This woman who runs a festival of letters in a little village called Maas in Switzerland. It was written in chalk in her hand. You know, poetry is a love letter to the world. Everything, I think, you know, even when I'm angry, I write it out of love. You know, I wrote a poem, a searing poem about the referendum, in which I laid bare all of my feelings about what happened. I called people some names, but I had to do something. I had to get this thing out. It will be published at some point. You know, legal challenges, legal threats will ensue. But yeah, like that line about poetry being a love letter to the world, it's always love, I think.
It's always love here on ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf, where I'm Kate Evans, talking poetry in collaboration with Red Room Poetry and with the ABC's Top 100's Book Countdown, as well as here at the State Library of New South Wales with poet Maxine Beniba-Clark, poet and academic Professor Sarah Holland-Batt, another professor and poet, Daniel Browning from the University of Sydney, and writer, journalist, podcaster and awe seeker, Julia Baird. Daniel raised there the whole question of poetry that is furious, poetry that is activist, poetry that speaks, bears witness, lays bare the world. Who wants to respond to that either as an idea or with an example of something that we should all read and know and think about?
It's a great definition. It's so many things. I mean, when you're talking about emotion linked to activism, because sometimes you're stripping something back to make people aware. And also thinking about Maxine's poem, I was thinking about Gwen Harwood's, you know, her poem, The Park? It's so good. And I know it's an Australian classic, but it has a woman. And so many women, so many mothers find themselves in this situation. You're sitting in a bench at the local park and your kids, they've got it here. She's like, her clothes are out of date. Two children whine and bicker. They tug at her skirt. A third's just drawing in the dirt. Someone she loved once passed by too late to feign indifference to that casual nod. And so they chat, how nice, etc. Time holds great surprises. From his neat head unquestionably rises a small balloon, but for the grace of God. They stand a while in flickering light, rehearsing the children's names and birthdays. It's so sweet to hear their chatter, watch them grow and thrive, she says to his departing smile. Then, nursing the youngest child, sits staring at her feet. To the wind, she says, they have eaten me alive. And that's, to me, is such a sucker punch at that. And every mother that I know, no matter how proud, no matter how devoted, no matter what greater source of joy your children are, will know those moments when you feel like you've been devoured alive, when you're exhausted and when you're depleted and when even a conversation with a passerby can be a struggle and can be a moment when you're confronted with all your own anxieties. And that's not to be dismissed as a moment that a mother has feeling sad on a bench. This is a lament about being a mother and about the human condition and the responsibilities we have and what is required of us and how we sometimes sublimate ourselves in search of service to other people. So that kind of, that sense of like bringing in the emotion to remind us of a broader issue, I often think of that poem.
And as you say, there's a sucker punch, there's a politics, there's a sort of feminist reading of it. It's putting us in a particular place in a park and in a moment, and there's this sort of undercurrent of fury as well. I mean, there's so much going on in that
one.
And
deep truth-telling, I think, as well.
And empathy too.
In a glossy world, even glossy Instagram. We've gone from Women's Weekly to friggin' Instagram now that tells us lies, but yes, empathy.
What it does is, as a man, I can still experience empathetically what's going on there. I mean, I may not feel the same thing, but the poetry communicates so empathically that I can well imagine what it feels like.
But also a man can probably relate to someone, a passerby, saying there, but for the grace of God.
Yes. Right. I mean, I related to him and then I related to her.
Yeah.
I mean, his words were cutting and searing and hurtful, but hers, you know, came back to her. I was definitely on her side.
Yeah.
I think what I love about that poem is the scope of it.
Mm.
Like, I love poems that it could be a short story. It could be a novel. There's just so much there. It takes your imagination to the life of this person.
Yeah.
And I love poems which do that. You know, you kind of, you're thinking about them long after, because it's the silences, you know, it's the things that are unsaid that make your, you know, your mind go back to it again and again.
Well, and you said it could be a novel, and I just read a novel by the New Zealand poet Louise Wallace called Ash. It's a novel, it's quite a short novel, but on the page it's very poetic. There are times when words fall off the page, are clumped together in these sort of furious blocks, other times when there's real spaces on the page. And it also made me think of the English writer Max Porter, who writes fiction that is so poetic.
Mm.
So what's going on with the blending of those forms? Is that also something that's happening now as we look at this past 25 years, or is it just part of a long tradition?
I think it's part of a really long tradition. And when you think of someone like James Joyce, that is poetry. Finnegan's Wake is just poetry. And I think the joy in language is not just the province of poets. This is something that novelists do, that prose writers do, and that question...
The rappers do too.
Yeah, rappers do. I mean, the question of what defines poetry as distinct from those other forms is not always easy, you know, to kind of define. And then you have little forms like microfiction that might in many ways resemble a prose poem. You know, poetry can be written in prose. Prose can be written poetically. I think the thing that for me, and I suppose we'd all have different definitions of where that kind of line rests, but I think the thing for me that defines a poem as opposed to these other forms is succinctness. So poetry is all about saying what you have to say in as few words as possible. The novel has the pleasure of sprawl. The poem is really trying to achieve something in a very, very condensed way, and in a way that relates to memory.
Mm.
And, you know, ideally when you love a poem, you can carry it with you wholesale in your head. There's very few art forms that operate that way.
Mm-hmm.
Song lyrics, for sure. We carry our favourite song lyrics in our heads. No one carries their favourite novel in their heads, or I doubt. So I think poetry is aiming for that portability. But, of course, the joy of language, experimentation in language, musical rhythm, all of those things can live in prose as well. But no, I don't think it's a new thing. I think it's old, and there's so many examples of, you know, older texts that draw in poetry or use poetry or blend poetry and fiction. But I'm so pleased when people, you know, consider the poetry that exists outside of the poem, because I think poetry is, you know, it's not just the province of poems. We find it in other forms.
I think everything should be written poetically, like everything, advertising. In a way, it harkens towards poetry. You know, the words have to be balanced. You know, have to look right on the page. I'm into the aesthetics of what I write as much as what actually meaning I'm conveying. So if it's the wrong word, it's the wrong letter, I won't use it. It might be the most appropriate letter, word, but I won't use it because there's too many H's. So it doesn't look right. It's that crazy.
Mm.
I'm crazy.
It's like the
line between the kind of art object, looking at a painting, and then a poem. You know, visual poetry, for me, art and poetry are the same thing. They're really not different.
Well, given that, let's build up our collection, particularly, as Sarah said, this idea that we can hold it with us. We can hold it in our mouths or our memories. And so here on ABC Radio National, let's do another round of favourite poems, favourite poets, things that you want us to take with you. Maxine Beneber-Clark.
Okay, I'm going to mention before I read this poem, Ali Cobby Eckerman, who's an incredible poet, and I'm going to mention her for her body of work.
Mm.
You know, she's someone who I don't necessarily have a favourite poem, but she's one of my favourite poets. And I was just saying on the way here, I realised I first heard her read about 16 years ago, and it was from a tiny little chapbook, a little bit long time. We both had these tiny little pamphlet books at the time. And I just remember sitting in the audience thinking, oh my goodness, I hope this person keeps writing. I hope I get to read more. So that's a recommendation. I'm going to read from a poem called Still Life with Police Sirens. Oh, and you probably won't be able to find it in text because it was a performed poem, so I've had to go through and write it down, but you'll be able to find it online, a performance of it, by two young African-American poets, Zora Howard and Joshua Bennett. And I'm only going to read a tiny bit of the poem. The poem is about a black family driving along. They get pulled over by the policeman and this girl has to watch her brother, who's 18, be terrorised by the police for the first time. The dad is also in the car. I'm not going to read that section. I'm going to read the section just before that happens, where they're kind of driving along in the car, because I just think it's a beautiful example of that idea that difficult poems are actually love poems as well. Still Life with Police Sirens by Zora Howard and Joshua Bennett. Before we are singing, pack or prince perhaps, anything unfettered, in tacit reverence of the open road of us, free and forever off the cuff. The inside of my daddy's Toyota Corolla becomes a mobile cipher at 50 miles per hour. There is only the melody of this moment and nothing beyond the back seat.
Still Life with Police Sirens by Zora Howard and Joshua Bennett. Sarah Holland-Batt.
I'm going to read a poem by the current UK poet laureate Simon Armitage. And the reason I read this poem is kind of mysterious even to me. I've taught this poem for many years, and every time I teach it, I've taught it for so long, as I read it, I'm almost brought to tears. Something about this poem just moves me. It's a kind of classic poem. It begins quite simply and it ends up as an elegy. But there's something about the way that Armitage marries the story he's telling with the music of the poem, and the way the poem ends with such a shock, that just has reverberated with me for a long time. The shout. We went out into the schoolyard together, me and the boy whose name and face I don't remember. We were testing the range of the human voice. He had to shout for all he was worth. I had to raise an arm from across the divide to signal back that the sound had carried. He called from over the park. I lifted an arm. Out of bounds, he yelled from the end of the road, from the foot of the hill, from beyond the lookout post of Fretwell's farm. I lifted an arm. He left town, went on to be 20 years dead, with a gunshot hole in the roof of his mouth in Western Australia. Boy with the name and face I don't remember, you can stop shouting now. I can still hear you.
The shout by Simon Armitage. I can see why that one
gets me every time. It's a beautiful elegy, and that's what the elegy can do, I think. It makes you feel the grief for someone that you've never known, never loved. And that the beauty of the sort of chanceness in that poem, this idea that it's someone who you used to know but you don't, but they haunt you, it's just a perfect poem in my view.
And poetry does do grief very well. Daniel Browning, what would you like to offer up to us?
Oh, my God. I was actually going to read a kind of, I suppose it's a love letter to another poet, but I won't. I'm going to read something from Evelyn Araluen's Strop Bear, a Stella Prize-winning collection. There's just so much to choose from.
That's a terrific little collection you're holding right
what
there.
What I really love about Ev is the critique. But this piece is called Decolonial Poetics. Avant Gaba. When my body is mine, I will tell them with belly and bones, do not touch this prefix or let your hands burn black with your unsettlement. There are no metaphors here. When I own my tongue, I will sing with throat and finger. Go back where you came from, for I will be where I am for. When I am auntie, I will say, Jarjums, look what we made for you. Look at this earth we cauterized, the healing we took with flame. I will show them a place they will never have to leave. And when I am dead, they will not say my name. And when you are dead, you can have poems.
And that one's by Evelyn Araluen, Decolonial Poetics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Evelyn Kaba, yeah.
We're building up this collection of poetry, this deliciously idiosyncratic collection of poems, and I promise the list will be available on the ABC Radio National website through the bookshelf. Julia Baird, help us build our collection.
Gosh, again, it's quite hard to choose. I wanted to read something by Candy Royale, though, because she is someone who had a big impact on me as well as a lot of other people. She died when she was 36 years old. I saw her when she last performed and she was a little frail but completely on fire. She meant a lot to a lot of people, and especially in the Red Room poetry community, I know that. And she spoke with such ferocity and tenderness from the margins. And she wrote a... And when I say the margins, I mean the centre. She wrote this poem... This is poetry, a stream of connected consciousness. I stress that I try to create work that releases hurt in people, because experienced alone, pain makes us feeble. This is a collective experience where we explore the human condition, both dark and in all its brilliance. We are more resilient than they lead us to believe. Self-determination means we can achieve, conceive a world where empathy and compassion are ingrained actions, tolerance, a practiced passion. A place where we know it's okay to be weak, we're fallible. It's part of what makes us unique. Perfection's a fallacy. More financial wants, pure fantasy. Life's more rich for those not perpetuating agony. I know that heaviness comes from being empty. Believe me, I've been broken plenty. There are parts of my mind I still deny. If I could tap into that, I'd be the greatest writer that's ever been. If I could unblock this, I'd be the greatest woman that's ever lived. So lend me your ears, it's redundant, now fear. Lend me your hearts, they're about to be broken open. These spoken tokens are far more than slogans. Chosen in moments where hope was fading but never faded, this heart never learnt to hate. Instead, I chose to create, to stimulate debate, refuse to remain sedate. I'll make shade when it gets too hot by sharing poetry and song with you, the important lot. People have power. It's more true than not. We don't have to be locked behind divisive lines. If I was king of the world and all the world was mine, I'd say above all, there's only one law, and that law is love.
And that one's by Candy Royale. And what's the poem called?
Oh, I'm not sure. Sorry. Oh, love. Love.
Love. And we could hear that sort of energy and rhythm and feel of. We could hear it as a piece out in the world over the airways. How, I mean, obviously you can read and see and engage with poetry on the page, but how important is it to think about it as performance and as words in the air? I mean, that's where you started, Maxine.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there are poems which only belong on the page because of their form or because they're, you know, concrete poems or whatever you need the form of them. But with all of the poems that we've read today, they just sound extraordinary out loud as well. I don't know if all poets edit their poems, reading them, but I certainly, if something is not reading correctly, I would rather edit it for voice than, you know, keep it reading like it is on the page. And that's because I feel like poetry is meant to be shared.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a testimony almost.
Absolutely.
So, it feels kind of like...
It needs to be heard. It needs to be felt. Like, it needs to be... it needs to vibrate. Mm. So if I'm writing a poem, I'll always enunciate, I'll always speak it out aloud. And then there's nothing more satisfying than when you get to the end and you've written the poem and it's like, that's done. And then you read it to yourself and it works.
Daniel, how can you say you don't consider yourself a poet? Seriously.
I write some poems occasionally. Because I think...
But it's vibrating through your body.
Yeah.
You're feeling it in your body, aren't you?
I am. It's like the thrumming of a, you know, didgeridoo or, you know, it's like blood pumping. You can hear it in your ears. It's just like, I think the act of putting it into the world is the powerful part. Because you've written it and it might just stay there. I was talking to Maxine about this. I wrote a poem that should never have been presented in public. It was commissioned by Red Room, and I performed it at Poetry Month a couple of years ago in front of a packed house, and it went down like a lead balloon. And from that moment, I realised there are certain poems that just should not be shared with the world. That poem was written for my sisters and my nieces and nephews. It was like, here are the stories that I was told about Granny. So if I die tomorrow, someone will remember. I wrote it down in a poem. So Red Room indulged me, and it was published in an anthology. There was no clicking, none of that. It was just like so dead.
I think it's a beautiful poem. And I have to confess, he told me this because I told him I'd read it out loud on the radio. But I think it works beautifully.
I think when you're talking about stuff that is only kind of really precious to... I mean, I think you'd get it, Maxine, because I'm talking about like lost memories or memories that are so fragile that they're not written down. This is all oral history. That my great-grandmother had a blue chaya service, and you know, she used to be a Jillaroo out west of Charleville. Well, that's not information that the world needs to know.
But sometimes a stunned silence doesn't mean something's gone down like a lead balloon. It can mean that it's hit you.
Yeah, I've got so much empathy. I think I empathised with them. I was like, yeah, no, you're right. Actually, it's like, no, you're right. But it was an important learning. Not all poetry is meant to be shared generally, I think.
Can be said about all sorts of writing and the practice of writing as
Absolutely.
Well. But I'm curious, Sarah Hollenbatt, whether that idea of the poetry that thrums through you and that you can feel in your blood and your bones, did that make sense to you, Daniel's description of...
I think it does. I think there's kind of an impossible quality to a poem that works. It just works, and when you hear it, you know. And I think often of, you know, the fact that a lot of people, not the people in the room, maybe not the people listening today, but a lot of people don't have much poetry in their life, but they still have poetry at their weddings and funerals. You know, poets always get the last say. I like to joke. But I think when you have those poetry in those occasions, there's always that kind of awed silence that follows it. And it's something about a different kind of language to our ordinary language, to our language with all the ums and ahs and, you know, wrong syllables and awkward phrasings. And there's something very arresting about poetry that we feel, you know, in our bodies. And there's some beautiful research about this that scientists, you know, have done, looking at the physiological effects of poetry. And people who love poetry have the same reaction when they read a poem that they love, say The Shout, that poem that I have loved and carried with me. You get the same sort of physiological reaction that you get when you get chills, you know, when you hear a beautiful piece of music that gives you chills. Mm-hmm. The body itself actually responds to poetry in lots of ways, and we know that poetry also works on memory in really kind of profound ways as well, that we do carry poems and they do shape our brains.
They carry histories, they carry songs of, you know, unspeakable.
Yeah, I think that carrying of history has become really important. A few years ago, my son was studying in year 10, I think, a Wilfred Owen collection. Mm. And at the time, I kind of, oh, my God, Wilfred Owen, I'm going to write a note to your teacher, you know, take it to them. But what has been documenting what's happening in Gaza other than the journalists, the poets, you know, and this is war poetry. It is war poetry of 2025. Mm-hmm. But you think of, you know, Albert Tucker, all those artists who went to war and were actually painting, you know, soldiers with their limbs missing and things like that.
Goya's Disasters of War.
Here at the State Library of New South Wales and on ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf, in collaboration with Red Room Poetry and the ABC's Top 100 Books Countdown, I'm Kate Evans, here with guests Daniel Browning, Maxine Beniba-Clark, Sarah Hollenbatt and Julia Baird. Please thank them all. That conversation about poetry was recorded in the lead-up to the 2025 Top 100 Books Countdown here on ABC Radio National. I'm Kate Evans, and I'll be back next time with more books.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.